Well, Jeff Shera has become the great chronicler of the Civil War with a rapid-fire series of books that have examined the war from a whole host of angles. He's now out with the third book in what will be a four-book set that looks at the Western theater of the Civil War. This book, The Smoke at Dawn, takes a close look at the decisive battle at Chattanooga that went a long way toward determining the war's outcome. Jeff Shera's work includes two books that bookend his late father's Pulitzer Prize winner, The Killer Angels. Those books were Gods and Generals and The Last Full Measure, both of which spent weeks on the bestseller list. In fact, almost every book Jeff has written has spent weeks on the bestseller list. He speaks in town at 7 tonight at Unity Temple on the Plaza, and it's a pleasure to have him back right here almost exactly 2 years since his last visit. And Jeff, welcome back.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, you're keeping to your schedule, a big book every 2 years, and that astonishes book people. I get the sense that you work pretty hard.
Well, I mean, I'm very fortunate to be able to do this full time, which is something I don't take for granted. My father was a writer all his life, had to work for a living. And I'm very lucky that I've gotten enough attention for my books that I am able to do it full time. That's enormously valuable because you can't stop and start. You get into a flow. It makes it so much easier.
But still, 2 years to produce this book, and I'm holding it in my hands, this is a big one.
Well, the research is the biggest part of it.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody knows anything about my work, I mean, I don't write history books. This isn't what you read in high school.
But it's still, not, having said that...
Well, I have to learn the history.
Yes.
I mean, getting into the heads of the characters, putting words in the mouths of significant historical figures, Ulysses Grant, William T. Sherman, among many others, in order to get to that point where I'm comfortable writing those words, I have to hear the voices. And I don't mean that in a schizophrenic way.
Yeah.
I mean, the research, all original source material, diaries, memoirs, collections of letters, an enormous amount of reading that goes into the research before I do a single bit of writing.
So how much of the 2 years is spent on research and how much of the 2 years is spent on writing?
It's about half and half. The research all comes first, and which also, by the way, includes walking the ground, going to the battlefields,
going
to the places. It's essential for me to get a feel. If I'm going to describe a hill to you and a kid's walking up that hill with a bayonet in his hand right into the guns of the enemy, it's really better if I've seen that hill and walked up it myself than just see a picture of it in a book. So there is a lot of travel with the research as well. Once the writing starts, though, it's a nonstop process. Often it'll be 7 days a week. It drives my wife crazy. But I have a nice office in my home, a nice library, and I isolate myself. And I liken it to a faucet turning on. And when the words are coming, let them come. And when the faucet turns off, you're done for the day.
Well, a lot of writers out there are going to hate you because you put out 500 pages in a year then, in terms of actually writing it. Again, that's going to anger a lot of writers out there, Jeff.
Well, I understand that. But again, I go back to my father. I mean, my father taught at Florida State creative writing and literature to make a living because he could never make a living from his writing. And most writers very well know this, that making a living from your writing is a rare thing to do. That's an enormous luxury that I don't take for granted.
So do you pretty much shut down the social life for that year when you're actually putting this thing out? It sounds like when you're going, you don't want to be interrupted.
Exactly. And there are those days when, I mean, sometimes the faucet doesn't turn on. I mean, there are those days when it just isn't there and I'll go fishing or something. I mean, you have to
you
do something.
You don't fight it.
No, you can't fight it. My father tried. I mean, again, growing up in the house of a writer, I learned some lessons. One of them is don't force it because it's never any good. If you try to force the words, whatever comes out isn't going to be very readable. And if it's not there, it's simply not there. Cut yourself some slack and just go for a walk.
You know, I love this story about you and your sort of the way you got into the profession of writing, because years ago, you were most widely known as one of the best coin and precious metals dealers in Florida. Your father, obviously the great Civil War novelist Michael Shera, died in 88. And a few years later, you had to make this decision about trying to write a prequel and a sequel to your father's big book, The Killer Angels. You had never written a book before. What made you think at that point in your life that you could do it?
Well, I had absolutely no idea that I could do it. I knew it was something I wanted to try. And the point, people ask me all the time, weren't you afraid?
Well, of course.
It was always about being a movie. It was about Ted Turner. I mean, Ted Turner had made the film Gettysburg based on my father's book, based on The Killer Angels. Ted had come to me and said he wanted to to make more movies. He was, you know, Killer Angels, I mean, Gettysburg made money, and he wanted to do more. And the idea is I would pull a story together, much as my father did, using the same kinds of research that I've described, and if someone else will adapt it for a screenplay. And we actually had the conversation, if whatever I come up with is lousy, it goes in the trash and nobody will ever see it. I happen to be representing my father's estate in New York. Random House has a number one bestseller with the Killer Angels now on the strength of the movie. 5 years after my father's death, he had no idea what he left behind. Well, Random House says, well, send us the manuscript. We'll take a look. Well, we're talking about Gods and Generals. I sent him the manuscript. The phone call I got back was, we don't care if it's a movie. We like the book. We think you're a writer. And they gave me a contract. I mean, that changed my whole life.
What was that moment like for you? Again, because I'm thinking the weight of your father's legacy must have been more than just a little heavy on your shoulders, Jeff.
When Gods and Generals came out in the spring of 96, it debuted on the bestseller list. And I was under no illusions that the great American author had arrived. I knew full well that people wanted more of the Killer Angels. It was a beloved book.
Yes.
I was cut huge slack by the critics. I mean, all over the country I toured, including here, I toured. And everywhere I went, I mean, people were, it was almost like people were rooting for this to work, which was a very strange thing. But I had a very difficult time standing up in front of audiences, holding up a copy of Gods and Generals and saying, look what I did. I mean, this was my father's book to write. I mean, he deserved it. The accolades that came to the Killer Angels came after his death, and he deserved to see that.
Well, at what point then in your career, and you've written so many books, did you feel like, okay, you can stand on your own two feet now as a writer, you know, of some renown in your own way?
Well, the bestseller list thing was very nice. I mean, any writer would want that. That wasn't enough. That really didn't do it for me. It was when I went back to the American Revolution. I got away from Civil War, and so I was away from what some people described as, someone said to me, you're out from under your father's shadow. I didn't really look at it as a shadow, but I also understood big footprints I'm walking in. When I went back to the American Revolution, and those books were equally as popular, that was a surprise, and I began to realize, of course, Random House is telling me this, you have a fan base now. Well, that just didn't resonate with me at all.
Yeah.
Very foreign concept. And yet the books were very successful. And then going forward to World War I and then World War II. And so my father suddenly is not a part of the equation anymore. And it really became about the characters I was working with, learning how to write. And I hope I can say that. And finding my own voice and being comfortable with that.
Civil War writer Jeff Shera is our guest. That first book you wrote, Gods and Generals, was it a struggle or not? And please tell me it was.
Well, it was a struggle because it was way too long. The first, I had a 1,200-page manuscript, which took about 18 months to write. I took it to New York, and when Random House decided to buy it, the first thing my editor, my brand-new editor, who I met for the first time,
yeah,
the first words out of his mouth were, we have to cut 400 pages out of your manuscript. So that was my sort of my indoctrination into the writing business.
How hard was that for you to do? Because that can be pretty painful.
Well, I've met writers who are purists who attack their editor with things like, how dare you change my work? I had none of that. I mean, my father actually was very much like that. No, I was completely out of my league is what I felt like. And here's a professional editor at Random House telling me, well, we need to do this. We need to tweak that, rewrite this. And I went along with it and it worked.
Was the writing of the book difficult for you?
Not really. It was... I took it upon myself to be a storyteller, knowing that that's what my father always called himself. He was not a historian. I was not a historian. The idea is to tell a good story. And once you get into the heads of the characters, once the research was done, and you feel like, and this is a strange word to use, but I felt as though I loved Robert E. Lee, and I loved Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, and these characters who are a big part of the story, That was an amazing thing to happen. The downside of that is when Stonewall Jackson, I knew this was coming all the way through the writing of the book, at some point I have to kill him. And that was one of the toughest things I've ever done. I was very emotional about that.
What comes first for you, the research or plotting out the story you're going to tell?
Well, the story, I mean, people ask me if I ever do an outline, and there is no, history is the outline. I mean, I'm writing real historical events, but, you know, with real people. It's a novel by definition because you're in their heads and there's dialogue. But the history, the historical event that I'm writing about is the outline. So I don't really need to worry about that. I dig right into the research. The hardest part is, who are the voices going to be? Who are the characters? Finding, because there's a lot of people to choose from, finding the ones that work or that I can really get into, that's probably the biggest challenge.
And then you come up with a plot at some point here.
Well, the plot, again, is the history. I mean, we're talking, I mean, if we talk about about the smoke at dawn, I mean, the plot is the campaign around Chattanooga. And one thing, and I'm very, very careful about this, maybe I'm even a little defensive about it, I don't embellish history. My job is not to jazz it up. Just tell the story. The story's,
because the story's already jazzed up.
Exactly. I mean, the history that we're talking about here is some pretty intense stuff. The characters are some pretty amazing people. My job is to get it right.
Jeff Scher is our guest. He's the great Civil War writer. His latest book, The Smoke at Dawn. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. You know, there's so many things, Jeff, I want to ask you about The Smoke at Dawn and this, you know, this incredible set of circumstances that led to this showdown in Tennessee. But I wanted to ask you also about just a sentence you write in the reader's note at the beginning of this book. And this is a note you wrote just a few weeks ago based on the dateline that's in this book. But you talk here about the power that the Civil War still holds over the American people. And you mention that you've been caught, and this is a quote, completely off guard by the extraordinary emotions that pour through many events, including both the Sons of the Union and the Sons of Confederate Veterans events that you go to. Tell me about that. What are you talking about exactly, these strong emotions that still pour forth?
Well, first of all, I'm very careful to point out, particularly when you're talking about the Sons of Confederate Veterans, that today there's a lot of politics attached to that. I mean, there's some controversies. I don't get into any of that stuff. I've been to a couple of banquets of Sons of Confederate Veterans, particularly in places like Memphis. What I found out, and I went in there with a lot of trepidation, like, what am I getting myself into here? And I hate to say that because, I mean, I'm embarrassed by that. What I found was these are people who have one function, one goal, and that is to remember their ancestry, pay attention to it, go back, look at the letters, the diaries, remember who was your great-great-grandfather. And when I realized that that's what these people were about, it's not about political correctness or incorrectness. It's not about politics. And it actually, I mean, I was sort of impressed by that. And North or South, people that you know that honor their ancestry. And I don't care whether you're talking about your dad who fought in World War II, your grandfather World War I, whatever it might be, or whether your family came over on the Mayflower. That's a good thing, and I'm very happy to see that.
But the passion that surrounds these events, the emotions sound like they're still extremely powerful.
Well, I was born in New Jersey, grew up in Tallahassee, Florida. So, I mean, here I am, a Yankee, going into first grade in a very southern school in Tallahassee, and kids are calling me Yankees. I didn't know what a Yankee was.
Yeah.
I never heard the word before. That passion, I mean, in the South particularly, I mean, the South lost the war. I mean, that's not news.
Yeah.
But that, the passions of that, the passions of what I'm actually working on right now about Sherman, I mean, a character like Sherman inspires, you know, some pretty strong comment, even today, 150 years later. There are many places in the South where, and it's almost cliche, and I don't want to make a joke out of it, but the war is still being fought. I mean, people have very, very deep-seated feelings about it.
You know, after all these years of studying this war and the various battles and the various personalities, and one thing we'll talk about again, and we did it 2 years ago, is your penchant for walking the land and really getting a feel for what that territory is all about. What do you take away from the Civil War that maybe the rest of us might not, whether it's, you know, new respect for Lincoln, whether it's new respect for Lee? I don't know what it is, but what do you take away that maybe I don't have about it?
Well, you touched on it right there. This is not John Wayne and the guys in the black hats. I mean, there is no bad guy here. When you read any of my books, whether it's, I mean, not just Civil War, but American Revolution, World War II, you read any of my books, you get voices from both sides. And both sides, what you find out is these are three-dimensional human beings. Mm-hmm. Again, it's not that the bad guy is one-dimensional and the good guy is this hero. My job is to tell you the story from both sides, to tell you an honest story, to tell you the way the characters themselves would tell it. Well, whether you're talking Robert E. Lee or Braxton Bragg or Patrick Claiborne on the Confederate side, or whether you're talking Ulysses Grant or Sherman or George Thomas, whoever it might be on the Union side, these are all people who are fighting this war for a very distinct reason, and they're really interesting characters. If they're not interesting, I can't get into their heads. I can't tell the story. I find those people, find those voices. That's what my books are all about.
Jeff Scherer, again, speaks this evening at 7 o'clock at Unity Temple on the Plaza. To grab a seat, call Rainy Day Books in Fairway, 913-384-3126. You live in Gettysburg, which seems so appropriate. What was the takeaway for you following the 150th anniversary of that battle, that huge battle just last year? What stood out to you from those events?
Well, I was there. I did 9 straight days of book signings, morning, noon, and night. It was a pretty amazing event. What surprised me was how many people, I mean, the busiest week Gettysburg has had in 50 years since the 100th anniversary, I was amazed at how many people told me they were there for the first time. They chose that week to go there for the first time, fight the traffic, fight for a hotel room.
How crowded was it?
It was pretty crowded. It was not chaotic. I will say that. The security, this was a very short time after the Boston Marathon explosions. Mm. There was an enormous concern that somebody would try something. Mm-hmm. And so the security, I mean, everywhere from the federal government, the FBI, all the way down to state police, local police, they were there in force, undercover mostly. I mean, but there was a presence there, and nothing happened. I mean, there were no events that took away from any of the historic importance of that. But beyond that, the people who came for the first time, how many of them said to me, I can't wait to come back. Mm-hmm. Well, those are new recruits, if you will. I mean, those are that's the future.
That was my experience when I went with my family. You go there, you get around it, and boy, you want to go back and spend more time, maybe get one of those interpreters to hop in your car and really tell you things that you can't glean just from going around by yourself.
I think what surprises people, and I talk about the backseat people. You know, you see a car on a battlefield, there's, you know, full of a family. The people in the front seat, those are the people who want to be there.
Yes,
they're looking at the plaques and the cannons and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And the backseat people are sort of going, oh, can we please go get lunch now?
Yeah, right.
Well, when the backseat people suddenly wake up and look around and go, oh, this is pretty interesting. And mm-hmm. It's beautiful,
one
thing.
Yeah.
I mean, to think of the horror that happened there and then look at what it looks like today. People are changed by that experience. I hear that all the time. It certainly changed me first time I went there when I was 12 years old. And that's true. I can give you a laundry list of battlefields that I strongly recommend people visit. Gettysburg's the top of that list, certainly. Those are people every American should visit. You don't have to be a Civil War buff. You don't have to be a historian.
You don't have to be, no. Now, I remember I was struck by two places. One was Little Round Top and where Chamberlain made his stand. And secondly, you can't help but wonder about the fields, the open fields where Pickett's charge took place, on that fateful day. And you look at the vast openness and what Robert E. Lee did to send his men across those, vast mile wide open field into the teeth of those cannons and the North shooting downhill at them. And it really rocked my view of Lee and what on earth was he thinking that day, because you stand up there on top of that hill where the North was and you can't quite wrap your arms around it.
Well, there's a real interesting sort of contrast on the northern side, what a lot of the soldiers said. These guys, they're sitting there with their muskets and their bayonets and they're hunkered down behind a stone wall. And when Lee's troops step out of the woods, a mile away, and a mile wide, 12,000 men step out of the woods, and many of these Union soldiers were staring at that and said it was the most beautiful thing they'd ever seen. This incredible formation, this parade ground formation of troops, and of course the troops start coming toward them. But even then, it's a mile away, so you're not really getting, you're not scared to death or anything yet. when the cannons start and the Union artillery begins to shell these Confederates walking across, as you say, wide open ground.
Yeah.
And by the way, walking.
Yes.
This Hollywood idea of the charge where everybody screams and yells and runs, you can't do that for a mile. Try that, you're not going to be in very good shape. They walk shoulder to shoulder, one step at a time, and the lieutenant's in front with his sword, the sergeant's in back yelling at him to keep the lines up. And here come the cannonball. First of all, the solid shot, like these are steel bowling balls, if you will, that just come ripping through the lines. As they get closer, there's explosive shot. And then, of course, when they get within 300 yards of the Union position, the muskets open up. And the musket fire, that awful sound of a cracking walnut, which is the sound of lead on bone. And, you know, you're walking and the guy next to you suddenly drops. Well, he may be a buddy of yours. Somehow you keep walking. That astonishes me right there, what it takes to do that. And yet, the courage, and when it's over, when if you're one of the lucky survivors and you get to the Union line, which some of the Confederate soldiers did.
A few of them did.
And then you realize there's no, and somewhere somebody sounds a retreat because there are so few of you left, there's nothing you can do. You back away. I love that. Think about it. You don't turn around and run. Nobody wants to be shot in the back. That means you're a coward. And so you step backwards and walk back down the hill until you get far enough away then to turn and make it back to your own lines. That story, the drama of that story,
that's a great description.
It's overwhelming. And
what do you make of Lee's decision to send those men up that hill? What's your bottom line after, again, living there and walking those fields and being so immersed in this, Jeff, for so many years?
That's a debate ongoing today with historians.
Is.
I mean, what was he thinking?
What was he thinking?
Up until that point, up until literally 2 months before that time, he had Stonewall Jackson. Stonewall Jackson died in early May after the Battle of Chancellorsville when he was shot by his own men. He died of pneumonia. Jackson would have, Jackson's audacity tended to carry the day, no matter, I mean, even when he was outnumbered, he would accomplish these incredible things on the battlefield. Lee didn't have Jackson anymore. He had this enormous faith in his army, not just in Jackson's presence, but the army itself. They could do anything. Up to that point, Lee had won several major battles over the last year prior to that. He believed his men could do it again, that there was no army on earth could stop them. Unfortunately for him and for the Confederates, he was wrong.
How quickly after that battle did he begin to think that, did he ever think, I made a mistake, that was the wrong thing to have done?
Within minutes. After that battle.
Longstreet is at his side.
As his men are coming back down to him, some of them carrying wounded buddies, some of them dragging themselves, using their musket as a crutch with their wounds, Lee says, he tells them, it's all my fault. And of course, the men, and this is another thing, the men love him. It works both ways.
Right.
The men fought for him. Men gather around him, rallying themselves and saying, let's go again. We're ready to do it again. Well, there was, and Lee knew this, there was to be no again. It was over.
Lots of key moments in the Civil War, 4 years, obviously. Is that the key moment of the entire battle, that final retreat off that hill and the South realizing it can't charge again?
Well, of that battle, yes. Of the war, no. Mm. And this is one of those debates that I get into with historians.
Yeah.
I've written books about this, and I wrote the last book prior to The Smoke at Dawn, Chain of Thunder, which is about the battle of the Siege of Vicksburg.
That's what we talked about last time. Yeah.
And the reason I mention this is because it's going on at exactly the same time as what's happening at Gettysburg. I'm sorry for, and all due respect, and I live in Gettysburg, and I get people mad at me all the time, but what happened at Vicksburg was more important to the war than what happened at Gettysburg.
Because
the Mississippi River suddenly falls wide open into Union hands, and so all those states in the north, and I'm talking Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, Illinois, Michigan, now can send men, equipment right down the Mississippi River all the way to the Gulf unimpeded. Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Kansas become irrelevant to the Confederacy because they can no longer participate, it really seals the fate of the Confederacy.
Jeff Scherer is here. We're talking about his new book, The Smoke at Dawn, and that really does begin to set up sort of where this book takes off, which is you've had Gettysburg, you've had Vicksburg, and suddenly there's this fight over this middle ground, the great middle area, I think you call it in this book, between the mountains and the river. Set it up for us and where this book takes off from, Jeff.
Well, first of all, I can't tell you how many letters I have gotten from people in Tennessee and Mississippi who said, you know, we're awfully tired of hearing about Robert E. Lee in Virginia. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a whole lot of stuff that happens west of the mountains that nobody ever talks about. They're absolutely right. The Battle of Shiloh, which takes place in southern Tennessee in 1862, is the bloodiest battle of the war up to that point. Mm-hmm. Five times the casualties they had at First Manassas, First Bull Run in 1861. That battle shocked the world. Mm-hmm. Like, oh my goodness, we have an actual war here. 5,000 casualties. Well, there were 24,000 casualties at Shiloh, and the death of one man changed the history of the war, Albert Sidney Johnston, mm-hmm. the Confederate commander. And we could, I mean, I could give you a long explanation why. I won't. But that story, it rises the star of Ulysses Grant, the star of Sherman. These people suddenly become presence. Then going from there to, again, I just mentioned Vicksburg, mm-hmm. And what had the campaign around Vicksburg and then the most serious rising star in the Federal Army, Ulysses Grant. And that's where his reputation really becomes cemented after that. But you've got all this euphoria in the North in 1863. Gettysburg, Vicksburg, two major victories. They're finally winning the war. And then 2 months later at Chickamauga, North Georgia, they lose. The Federal Army suffers a crushing defeat, retreats to Chattanooga.
And your book talks about the maneuvering that went on there and the big mistake the North made at that point.
Yeah, William Rosecrans, the Union general, literally pulls a division out of the middle of his line to move it. He's looking at his own maps, and he gets it wrong. He moves a division, creates a gap right smack in the middle of his line. At the same time, on the other side, James Longstreet is making an attack. Well, Longstreet's people attack where they think they're going to be federal troops. They find themselves walking right through open ground. The Federals are gone. They're on both sides. And it splits the Federal Army in two. It panics both wings of the Federal Army. And they make a mad scramble back to the one safe place at Chattanooga. That's how the story begins. And then you have some people that sort of, again, rise to the top. George Thomas, the Rock of Chickamauga, he gets that name. He's the one federal commander who does hold his ground and preserves the retreat for a lot of his own men.
Keeps the South from absolutely swallowing up the North in that retreat.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, the Union Army under Rosecrans goes back to Chattanooga. Rosecrans suddenly is not the favored son in Washington. The North has just lost this catastrophic battle, and the War Department elevates Ulysses Grant to command of that entire part of the war, from the mountains all the way to the Mississippi. The first thing Grant does, he fires Rosecrans.
Yeah.
The second thing he does, he promotes George Thomas in command of that entire army, and then Grant goes to Chattanooga himself, and with him comes William T. Sherman. So this gathering army in Chattanooga. The other side of this story is even more interesting to me. You have the Confederate commander who wins the Battle of Chickamauga,
Braxton Bragg. Yeah.
And I've told people, you know, if you liked John C. Pemberton, the guy who loses Vicksburg, you're going to love Braxton Bragg. This is the most despised man in the Confederacy. Bragg wages war with his own subordinates more than he does with the Yankees.
Yeah.
There's a petition signed by all his generals to remove him from command, a petition that goes to Jefferson Davis in Richmond. Well, sorry, but Jefferson Davis likes Braxton Bragg, and he keeps him in command. Probably the biggest mistake of the war.
Again, we're visiting with Jeff Scherer, the great Civil War chronicler here. 816-235-2888 is our number. David from Lenexa, good morning.
Good morning. My comment is I think Bull Run was more influential because it determined the overall view of what was going to happen. The Federals thought it was more of a picnic, a Sunday picnic, and I think it could have been won there. The whole war could have been won had they taken it sincerity. It wasn't, you know, the Confederacy wasn't taken with, as a real fighting force, and they were.
David, thank you. Bull Run is the most
influential
battle.
You're absolutely right on one account. I mean, the Federal Army, I mean, the socialites of Washington, D.C., might get in their carriages with their brightly colored clothing and with their picnic lunches, and they go down to Manassas to witness what they think is going to be our gallant boys in blue, you know, sweeping aside this rabble.
Yeah.
Well, the rabble sends the boys in blue scampering back to Washington, along with all these wagons and these panicked socialites. And that's where they get the first taste of the fact that, oh, yes, okay, this isn't going to be as easy as we thought it was.
Yeah.
But that's the beginning. And again, 5,000 casualties, which horrifies Washington as well as horrifying Richmond, and yet it pales in comparison to what follows. It certainly opens the door to the fact that this is a real war, and we didn't expect this.
Yeah.
But it's only the beginning.
You know, it's fascinating to me that, Jeff, that it takes until, you know, this book, 1863, you know, heading toward 1864, for President Lincoln to finally get his general after going through man after man after man. You know, Grant, when this book begins, doesn't have control of the entire theater that you're writing about here. He eventually does. How long it took, what a frustrating journey that must have been for Abraham Lincoln.
Well, Lincoln, first of all, one of the things that happens in both armies, actually, is politics. A lot of the generals, and I love this, a lot of people don't realize, when your local town raises a regiment to go off to war, the regiment themselves elect their officers. And so the local town mayor or the banker or whoever the most influential guy in town, he becomes the colonel.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean he knows anything about leading troops in the field. Well, eventually, after a couple of years of disasters, and especially on the northern side with the leading generals from McClellan to Pope to Burnside to Hooker, these people, they get sort of moved out of the way. And when Lincoln is desperately looking for someone who knows how to win. And after Vicksburg and also Shiloh and a few fights before that where Grant has been victorious, Lincoln has an instinct that he's finally found the guy. And it, obviously, he was right.
And Grant had what that the other generals did not, Jeff?
Grant understood, as did Sherman, that a war is not a gentleman's disagreement where you slap each other with gauntlets and step back 30 paces with pistols. That's not what a war is. A war is vicious. It is evil. It is mean. It is bloody. It is deadly. Everybody will suffer. And that's a concept that isn't really, that's not gentlemanly. It's not chivalrous. The Civil War changes all of that. Grant and Sherman are the two people responsible. The other part of that is Grant realizes he's got the resources. It's a mathematics equation. In the North, with the factories, with the manpower, he knows that a war of attrition is a war he can't lose. Because every 100 men he loses, if he can kill 100 Confederates, he can replace his 100, the Confederates can't.
Jeff Scherer is our guest. His latest book, The Smoke at Dawn. Let's go to some phone calls again. Mark from Weston. Mark, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Yes, I wondered if Mr. Scherer, in upcoming books, is going to explore the Kansas-Missouri border war that kind of was a prelude to the Civil War.
You knew that question was coming. Jeff's nodding his head, Mark. Yeah,
I knew the question, and it's a fair question. And the answer right now is I've got a really full plate. One of the problems I'm always challenged by is my publisher. We decided to do, and this is actually going to be a four-book series.
It was going to be three.
It was going to be a trilogy.
It was three the last time you were here a couple years
ago. That's right,
yeah.
And we realized we had to expand it, include more history. I call it now a four-book trilogy. There are other, besides Kansas and Missouri, Nebraska, I mean, this whole part of the country. I mean, we're talking John Brown. We're talking Quantrell.
There's some
amazing stuff out here. There's also the battles of Franklin and Nashville in Tennessee. Those people are mad at me because I'm not doing that fight, as well as the people in New Mexico, Glorieta Pass, the farthest west battle of the war. I can't do it all. And mm-hmm. I'm not Shelby Foote. You know, I'm not a historian. I try to find characters and tell that story and take you all the way through a series with certain specific characters. The chronicling of all the events, and I'm not diminishing what happened here. I mean, there are a lot of battles I have not written about. It's just, it's what I have to do, and I've got a publisher in New York who wants me to do other things, such as Korea. We're looking at Korea.
Oh, really?
Down the road, absolutely. And the war for Texas independence, what a lot of people know as the Alamo, we're talking about that. So I have a very full plate.
You know, your enthusiasm for this topic still seems sort of boundless. Do you get tired of it?
Oh, no. I mean, well, if I do, it's time to quit.
Yeah.
I mean,
you haven't yet.
Not yet.
Jeff Scherer's new book, The Smoke at Dawn. He speaks tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Call Rainy Day Books in Fairway to grab a seat, 913-384-3126. Jeff, always good to have you here.
Thank you.
Congratulations on yet another one.
Thank you.
You bet.